This is an oral history interview with Oles Anderson of the R.E. Oles Company, 702 Michigan National Tower, Lansing, Michigan, 48933, phone 482-1538, at the Oldsmobile History Center on May 13, 1991, with Helen Early of the Oldsmobile History Center. Mr. Anderson is the grandson of Ransom Eli Oles, May 13, 1991. Well, Oles, I guess we're in business here.
All right. This is Monday, the 13th of May, and my name is Oles Anderson, sometimes known as R.E. Oles Anderson, 702 Michigan National Tower, Lansing, and birthday?
Birthday, but you got a phone number?
Yeah, 482-1538.
Fine, and your birthday, if you will.
And the birth date is 23 August 16.
Okay. Oles, I meant to ask you last week, does your family have a family tree that we might have a copy of for our history file? Or could you draw, kind of sketch out a family tree, like starting with Pliny Oles, Mr. Oles' father, and then Oles' side of it?
Well, we have some books that Mother collected that go back to the Revolution and trace the family. It's not a family tree as I'm thinking of it, a picture, something like that, but it's spelled out pretty much in two or three different books that we have.
Okay.
They were published in Washington, private publication, but not for us, for somebody else. I don't know where Mother got them, but they're quite complete, and she has put her own notations in there to bring it up current.
I see. Now then, that would include birth dates or death dates and names of children
that
she and Ransom Oles had.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Okay. Well, if we could borrow something that we could sort of make a concise little family tree for your personal file here, that would be a good reference.
Oh, sure. I can bring that out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Somebody was telling us, Oles, that your mother had written a history, an Oles family history, or had worked with someone on an Oles family history.
I wouldn't be surprised, and I think that's the outcome of this. These two or three books I just mentioned. She did keep a journal of her own activities, and I would have to ask my wife where that is. Then, too, of course, my sister would have a lot of information on it, on the family, and much of it that I don't have. This is not my main interest, history, although ancient history is, but the family history, to me, it's just pretty much as I hear it. I'm no authority on it, in other words.
Okay. Now your sister, that would be
Peggy. In California.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And she, if you want to write her, wife, or I can call her and tell her what you might like, see what she can do.
Well, would that, which way would be, you think might work the best, would be better to do it?
Why don't I phone her and then tell her that you're going to follow it up with a letter? Then you'd have something to go on to.
Okay, very fine. That would do. That way we'd have her address and phone number too. And yes, we'd like to do that. And maybe that way we could fill in some more missing pieces to the historical setup that we're trying to work on. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That period then would cover starting with Pliny Oles or the Ransom Oles that Peggy used?
No, it would start with, he pronounced it Pliny.
Oh, Pliny.
Pliny, yeah. And I think it would start with Pliny.
Okay.
And then work up to present time.
Good. What did you call your grandfather? Grandpa?
Or? Well, I called him Grandpa or Gramp. But in visiting with other people, that is outside the immediate family, the most natural thing for me to do is just say Mr. Oles. So during this interview, when I say Mr. Oles, why, it's my grandfather, but that's just the way I always addressed him.
Okay.
Out in public, shall we say, or in talking about him in general conversation.
When you were growing up, Oles, and you were going to school, I know your family associated with a lot of people in Lansing, or a number of people who were in responsible positions, banks, doctors like that.
Mm-hmm.
Did you sense that your grandfather was any different, had perhaps a little higher prestige, is more noted, for instance?
No, I was never aware of anything like that. I really was never aware that he was such a national figure until I went away to school, or until, and then it wasn't very apparent, or until I, I'd say in the recent decade or two decades. And it always amuses me now. And I say it seriously, and it's interesting. When I would pull into a gas station, and this happened about 15 years ago, and the young cashier said, well, here's a living legend, when they looked at my gas card. Well, I'm never aware of that. And so I get kind of a chuckle out of it. I don't know where they get it, but people do.
Don't you think there's more interest being paid now in automotive history, the automotive greats who
Yes.
made the industry what it is?
Yeah, there really is. I get calls frequently that, you know, did Mr. Oles do this or do that? Or we have a picture of a yacht that's supposed to have been his, and can you identify various things? Yeah, I think so.
You're mentioning questions that come to you. Is it all right once in a while we get a question too that we feel you could better answer than we?
Oh, sure.
That's okay.
Yeah. I've often, and I take this seriously, I believe the older we get, the more of a reference figure we become.
Certainly.
Because we have lived it, have lived through it. And so it just seems one of those natural things that come with age.
What does the Ari Oles Company do, Oles?
Well, when Mr. Oles had it, it was a large investment company, stocks, bonds, land, very active holding company, I guess we'd call it today. Today, it is, as I use it, it's pretty much of just an umbrella for family affairs and references. For example, when you fill out an application or you go to a hospital or something, are you employed? Yes. By whom? Ari Oles Company. And that seems to be sufficient. So I just use it again as a reference name.
What about the Ransom Fidelity? When is their responsibility?
Well, that's the oldest one in Lansing. I think it was chartered in 1913 or 14. And until we broke it up a few years ago, it was the largest in this part of the state. Woody Rowe is the president and the chief CEO for years and years and years, and then when we broke it up, everybody went their own way, and so I'm responsible for what's left. But that's strictly a charity. It's strictly a foundation for charitable, educational, good works, things like that.
I see. Now you say that was the oldest one in the state.
Well, it was the oldest one, at least in this area of the state.
I see.
And it was set up strictly for charitable purposes, and it still is. We don't, it's a private foundation, and we don't, for example, make any kind of contributions, loans, or otherwise, to individuals. We just plain don't. And if an individual has a project, and the project is sponsored by a qualified organization, we'll take a good long look at it, and maybe we will, maybe we won't fund it. But it's strictly a foundation in every sense of the word that we use it today.
And then you say, now when was it broken up?
Well, I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago. Woody and I had talked about it for several years, and Peggy, living in California, thought it'd be best if she could take a share, her share, and move it out to California, and the Rowe family took their share and moved it down to the Greater Lansing Foundation. And so I have what's left of the original company.
I see.
And we operate it the same way, but it's considerably smaller.
Now, you consider nonprofit groups.
Oh, yeah, 501c3.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's really about all. If it's anything but a 501c3, we check it out pretty thoroughly if we think that it's worth the funding. And we get a lot of different requests every day.
Could you give us a ballpark figure of how many requests for assistance you
get? Well, I would say at the end of a given week, we would have 15 anyway. And I answer every single one of them so that at least they aren't holding their breath. But yeah. And especially now with the cutback on the state funding and federal funding and stuff like that.
Yes. Those same groups need even more support
because
they're losing it in another area. Well, I know you've been very instrumental in helping the Areoles Transportation Museum. They're very grateful.
Yeah, we don't. There's a good example right there. We don't particularly help operations. But we do help with capital improvement, capital maintenance work. And lately we've been helping out on the membership drive by matching at the end of their drive dollar for dollar that they bring in up to a certain point so that they, in effect, they get twice the number of memberships.
Oh, what a nice idea.
So that, and it helps us, and it helps them apparently, because they can very easily say, "Well, look, this is being matched. If you want to join, whatever it is, how much it is, then this will be matched." So it's the equivalent of double the dues. Seems to work out. It did work out last year, and we're doing the same thing this year.
Great. Are you a life member of the museum?
Yeah, we help them get started, and we put a roof on, I guess, some of the new, I shouldn't say the newer parts of the building. It's new to the museum, but it's an old structure. You know, where Bates Motors were right next door. So we help them get the roof on that and different things so that... We kind of stand in the background, but the local people do most of the work, and it's certainly gratifying to see what they do, because they pitch right in.
I think we're on the right track down there now.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Is it possible to interview Woody Rowe?
I'm sure it would be when he gets back. He isn't back from Florida yet.
I see.
So, but I'm sure it would be. He knows a great deal about the foundation, about the Fidelity, and the Ariel's company. He was there right after World War II and worked with Dick Lyman and Louis Hull and a lot of those people while I was still out flying around the countryside in behalf of the government. Then I went into the hotel, Hotel Olds, and only when Mother decided that she would like a little relief with her part of the Ariel's company, that's when I became interested in the family business as such. Prior to that time, I was always out in the field someplace.
Well, Olds, why don't you fill us in on your education from the grade school on up, and then your stepping into your the Olds family responsibility, and you mentioned you were out in the field, you mentioned you were flying, and then the Hotel Olds.
Well, I went to the public schools here. I went to the old Kalamazoo Street School, which is long gone, but it was a red brick building, and I think I went there the first 3 years. And then when they tore that down to build the present structure, I went to the Cherry Street School, and then to back to Kalamazoo in the new building, and 1 year at West Junior, and then in 29 they figured out that maybe I wasn't getting the education I should have, but only because I was successfully resisting it. It wasn't from lack of effort on the teacher's part. And so I went away to school, Cranbrook School, for 6 years, and graduated in 35, then went to Dartmouth for 1 year, and then transferred to Michigan State for 1 year. By that time, we were almost at war. So I applied for and got a job with the Civil Aeronautics Administration as a link trainer instructor and was assigned to Houston, Texas, at the standardization school down there. And I was there approximately 8 years. But I helped to move up to Oklahoma City, where the school now is. And that's when I came back with the idea of going back on the family farm. But it didn't work out that way. They needed some help at the hotel, so I started in the storeroom down there. And then...
It was the late 40s?
Yes, the late 40s. Mm-hmm. And then helped them sell the hotel to the Jack Tar chain. When was that? 70? 60, 70, somewhere in there. But by that time, why, I had worked into the office enough, so I was down there helping my mother almost every day, and that's when I became familiar with what Woody had been doing, because it was a joint operation. And
then your mother then was doing... What was her responsibility?
Well, her responsibility was her share of the Fidelity. The way we operated that, we estimated the annual income, and then Woody took half of it, and Mother took half of it, and gave it to the people they thought needed it. To the organizations they thought needed it. Hillsdale College, from my mother's standpoint, Kalamazoo College, from Woody's standpoint. We didn't try to make equal gifts, but we estimated the 50-50 deal on an annual income. So there were many times when Woody would give to things that we would have no idea what he was giving to, and because after all it was a 501c3, and by the same token we would do the same thing. So it was all a legitimate ethical operation. It's just that we had two branches of the same tree.
Well, now, Woody's mother, Bernice, she wasn't involved like your mother was.
No. Bun was a different type of a person and was not particularly interested in investments, for one thing, business operations for another, and so she seldom came to the office, and Woody took care of the family's business from that standpoint.
Well, what about her husband?
Well, he was, of course, he had a responsible job. First, as I remember it, I think first at Rio, and then the Ideal Power Lawnmower. But then when the Depression came along, or a few years after the Depression, the lawnmower business never really recovered as they were set up to manufacture lawnmowers. And that's when the rotary type of lawnmower came out instead of a reel. They eventually got into the rotary, but it was a little bit too late at that point. And mass production came from, the competition was real heavy from every place. And Ideal Power just weren't set up for it.
Where were they located?
They were over on East Kalamazoo, right by the railroad tracks where Capital City Lumber is now. That great big building used to make lawnmowers.
On the north side or the south side?
The south side, yeah. Across the street from what used to be the Michigan Butter and Egg, which is now that refrigerator plant.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, they were still in business when I was at West Junior, because in those days we had a very, very fine course or requirement of manual training. And I guess the educational people nowadays think that that's degrading because they don't teach it as they used to. But we had to learn how to make cement. We had to learn how to handle tools. It was strictly a manual training thing. And it was a wonderful course, required. I'm sorry that it isn't today. But every now and then, we would get behind, and we'd have to go down to Ideal Power and get our lumber sawed up so that we could go back to class and then continue the work on a box or whatever it was manually. And that, it really paid dividends.
Well, then after this Ideal Power Company didn't make it, what did Woody do?
That was Blondie who was down there.
Blondie.
Yeah. And he was on a bank board. He did various community projects. That's about all I can tell you.
We won't get into him because we're going to cover him another
time. Yeah, Woody can tell you about that.
Sure. Then Bernice was more a retiring and a home person, mm-hmm. more than like your mother, Gladys. Now, her job at the hotel was...
No, she was never in the hotel. My father was. But she was very active civically in a lot of committees, very active in YWCA work, and helped found the Junior League here. At that time it was called something else, forgotten, Junior something. But she was out on various committees at Hillsdale College, Michigan State, close friends of John Hanna and Jack Breslin, very active in a community way, but also interested in the office and the Ari Olds Company and in her own affairs, and did much of her own investing in handling of stocks, bonds, and so forth.
So you and she worked together in that project?
Well, I went in to help her out, yeah, because every now and then she'd get behind, and then it was just a normal transition that as she got older and became involved in more outside things, then I stayed in the office.
I mean, was your office always in the tower?
Michigan National Tower, Olds Tower.
Olds Tower.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, we used to have the 10th floor, all of the 10th floor, but then conditions went along and it contracted down to, oh, perhaps a third of the 10th floor. In the meantime, Mother and Bun sold the tower to Howard Stoddard, to the Michigan National Bank, and then they moved us down to 7, where we are now, which is very adequate for what we need. It's a great place.
So you say your mother and Bernice sold the tower to Stoddard.
Well, yeah, when my grandfather died, I don't know whether they inherited it or had owned it or something, but in any event, they ended up as the owners.
I see.
And it became one of those things that it was a major operation to maintain a building like that. And they felt that Michigan National could do a better job. And they had a meeting of the minds and sold it.
When did your mother cease coming down to the office?
Well, that's hard to say, because she would, of course, she would not come in when she was out of town, but lots of times she'd be too busy to come in, so it was just tapering off.
Okay.
That's about the best I can say. And as she tapered off, I went in more and more. Then, of course, when the hotel was sold, I had plenty of time, and then I would start coming in almost every day.
Now, at the end, you started in the hotel as a stock boy, you were telling
mm-hmm,
us. And
mm-hmm.
then you worked up to, what were you doing at the last before you left?
Well, I was the general manager at the end.
Okay.
And of course, you can't be in a business like that without having friends all over the country. And it was through some of those friends that I met the Jack Tar people, and they had previously been interested in buying the hotel, but for one reason or another, it didn't work out at that time. So when I went to a convention in Chicago, that friendship was renewed with Jack Tar people, and the outcome was they bought the hotel. It's part of the Jack Tar chain.
Well, now, who owned the hotel then? Did the family?
No, it was a stockholding company. It was publicly held stock. And there were two companies, the operating company, which leased the hotel from the Hotel Olds. Now I can't think of the name of the holding company. But the holding company didn't have a great deal to show for itself unless the operating company made money. But my father was so good that when we sold the hotel, not one investor lost a dime. They all went home with money in their pockets. They all went home with the interest that had accrued on their bonds or whatever it happened to be, and that was the end of it.
Now, what was your father's position there at the hotel?
Well, he was the president and general manager, and he took over in 1932, and it must have been around 1962 or so. I don't recall those dates exactly. It's when he retired, and then the board made me the manager, And of course, I was familiar with the operation and everything. But when Jack Tar came along, wanted to buy it for enough money that everybody got paid off, why, of course, we sold it.
Okay.
Nobody lost a dime, but that's all credit to my dad.
Bruce Anderson was a good manager.
Oh, yes, he was. He was a former banker. When he came to town in 1914, I think it was, I think he started with Blondie at the Ideal Power Lawnmower, but then he went up to the Capital National Bank, and then in 32, Mr. Olds said, you're pretty good with money, why don't you get into this hotel business? And he said, I don't know anything about the hotel business. And characteristically, Mr. Olds said, well, you can learn. And he did, and it was a very profitable relationship for everybody.
Now, you mentioned Blondie. Who is Blondie?
Well, that's Clarence Rowe, Woody's father.
Oh, yes. He was at the Ideal Power.
Yeah, he was an MIT graduate as well as... state, and... they were the young men at that time, they were just out of college, just trying to get started. So
power lawnmowers were pretty good.
Yeah, because they were new at that time, and Ideal Power was a really thriving concern. Well, it was a great place for young college graduates to get started, so they both started. I wasn't there, of course.
No.
That's what I understand.
What is your education, then? In the colleges you went to, did you have certain subjects you enjoyed, you were zeroing in on?
Well, yes and no. At Dartmouth, it was a gentleman's education. At Cranbrook, it was just a very, very fine education that... it was a strict school, but it was a very good school. And believe me, you either learned or moved on at Cranbrook. And I think I had some of the finest teachers that have been there, especially Dr. Stevens, who was the headmaster at that time. And it was patterned after the English private school, only the English called what we call private school, they call them public school. I don't know why. But in any event, that was the pattern in those days. Nowadays, I guess it's quite a bit different. But then at Dartmouth, it was a gentleman's education, although I had a...
What is that?
Well, the classics. And I was in an experimental English class. Experimental in the sense that it was patterned again after Cambridge, Oxford, where you don't have a regular curriculum set up. You're given an assignment and it's up to you to finish it up. And it's ironic because at Dartmouth, I just barely squeaked through physics. And yet when I got into aviation, that was the very thing that I was teaching. So you never know what you're going to run into down the road. But that's what I call a gentleman's education, as opposed to transferring to Michigan State when I wanted to get into agriculture, which was then a scientific directed course of study. And so because we had a farm, I was interested in it. And I got along very well at the with the courses.
Where is this farm located?
It's southwest of town of Lansing, out at Millet. Section 35 of Delta Township, Eaton County.
Okay.
And
near Wapusta?
No, right on the river, on the Grand River.
Okay.
You may remember where the Grand Manor was.
That
that very fancy restaurant that Dr. Badgley put together?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that was the home that my mother and father built. And we had 300 acres out there. It had a 600-tree sugar bush for maple syrup, lots of grazing land, and enough tillable land. I don't think we ever made money, but we came close to it.
Oh, when you say grazing land, did you raise cattle?
Cattle, mm-hmm.
What kind of cattle?
Well, sometimes if the market looked good, we would get into white-faced steers. But most of the time, for a steady income, we had Guernsey milk cows, Golden Guernsey, and we sold milk to Heatherwood Farms. We sold milk originally to the Lansing Dairy Company when we had Holstein. And
how many cows, milk cows, would you have?
We could accommodate, and usually did 20 to 24.
And then you had people working for you to milk them and take care of them?
Oh, no. There was another man, Henry Schlegel, and I did the whole thing. And then from time to time, we had a third man, a hired man, And it was just the three of us for the most part. So that it kept us busy.
Did you have any other animals?
We had, originally at that time, we had two teams, because we did not have a tractor. Finally, we got a Fordson tractor at an auction. And at that point, now this was before the war. This was about 1938. We got a Fordson tractor and discovered that maybe that was going to help us more than we thought. Because prior to that time, Henry was an excellent teamster, and we got along fine with two teams. And I learned how to drive them, too. But we found out machinery was the way to go, and we went that way.
What did you raise out there? Was it all under cultivation, the 300 acres?
Yeah, except for the sugar bush and the permanent pasture, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What did you raise? What crops?
Well, we had wheat, barley, buckwheat, alfalfa, had a lot of alfalfa because there was a good market at that time, and corn, of course.
Did you have riding horses?
Well, Dad had a riding horse when we were still in school, when Peggy and I were still in school, and he got Peggy a horse. We saw a picture of it, you know, on the videos.
Yes.
But by and large, well, you know, in 1937, when I was first married, we had, Barbara and I had a riding horse. In fact, we had at least two, maybe three, but two. And I remember that one was a jumper. We bought him over near Battle Creek. And so we had, well, a couple of good years of riding. In those days, the country roads, Kreitz Road and Canal and all those, they were gravel. So we could ride out there in almost without any problems with automobiles. Oh, it was a great area.
I should say so.
Yeah.
Well, how long did you keep this 300 acres? Did that farm always stay that same way, or was it later subdivided?
Well, no. During the war, conditions at... See, I was in Texas, so I... This is hearsay.
Did you sign up with the service?
Well, I was flying professionally then for the Civil Aeronautics Administration. And Mother was kind of holding down the fort at home. But conditions got to the point where nobody could afford to have a lot of luxuries that went on that we didn't even think as luxuries before the war. So gradually they sold off and curtailed the operations on the farm, and Henry then left and went to Michigan State, where he farmed for, I believe, either that or he... No, he was a good diesel mechanic, and I think he went into one of the shops here. But Anyway, the farm gradually shut down. Not entirely, because when the war was over and when I came back, Don White was living in the farmhouse. And he was doing the farming with what little we had. The first spring, I remember, I thought, well, now we'll get out and at least have an income through maple syrup. Well, come to find out, all the sugar bush equipment had been sold off, so that was gone. And the evaporator tanks and everything else. So it was almost like starting from scratch, and that's one thing that kind of convinced me maybe I better get into some other line of work. So that's when I went into the hotel. But
where did you learn flying?
Oh, out here. Harvey Hughes was my first instructor, and Carl Parker soloed me. I flew with Bob O'Dell and Roger Don Ray, and of course Dick Marsh. He and I became very close friends. Well, there were a lot of the old-timers. I'm trying to think of the young man now that lost his life in Alaska.
Wiley Folk?
No, he was a Lansing man.
Oh.
But in any event, we did a lot of flying. That's where I learned to fly. And then when I went to Texas, it was as a link trainer instructor. So I learned more about flying down there. And my boss down there was Bill Jones, and he's retired. And whenever I get to Oklahoma City, I always see him. We go out to dinner and talk about the fellows that we knew and who are still around. We're getting to be old-timers in that field.
Well, now, when was it that your folks built the home out there on by the river?
Well, they started in 29, and we moved in 32.
How large a home was that? Remember?
It was a couple of sizes smaller than Meadowbrook down in Detroit. It was a Tudor-type home, a rambling stone structure. I don't remember the square footage or you know, things of that.
9 bedrooms,
oh, yeah.
Large.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they could entertain 100 people and never know it. So it was big.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any of the parties and functions that you attended out there when you folks?
Well, yeah. For instance, when Blondie Rowe had his 50th birthday, they had a junior-sized track meet. And this was on the 14th of July, Bastille Day. We always made a big point of that. And the track meet consisted of the javelin throw with toothpicks and the high jump. We jumped over matches that were put up on twigs. Different things like that, and it was a real fun affair.
Yeah, well, what year was that?
Oh, gee.
Maybe 70s?
No, that it 60s. Would have to be in the late 30s, I
late
think.
Late
yeah.
30s. Okay.
Yeah, it was before the war, I know that. I kind of predicate everything before the war and after the war, because the war just turned the world upside down. And a person today would have a real cultural shock if he were transported back to 1935.
Oh, yes.
And it was just plain different, that's all. But it was a great place out there. The Christmas parties were big affairs. And
those would be Lansing friends that would be invited?
Or? Yeah, Mother and Dad would have... I don't know whether they catered in those days or not, but they always had quite a hospitality at Christmas time.
Would that be a full meal, a sit-down dinner?
Sometimes, but not for 100. That the 100 would be a cocktail party, something like that, with hors d'oeuvres, and that's all. But, they really had big times. We were right on the river. They had a couple of boats that you could go rowing or canoeing or whatever you wanted, you know, like that.
Well, then you and your family, Bruce and Gladys and Peggy and you, would go often on trips with Mr. and Mrs. Orr?
Well, in the early days we did, because our family was organized and scheduled by Mr. Olds. And while he had a very nice way of doing it, you did it. So when it was time to go, like we saw the movies of the North Cape trip.
Yes.
Well, there was a little resistance when that was sprung, but you'll notice we were all there. And he always did interesting things. Don't misunderstand me, because it was always for the good of the group, and everybody had a thoroughly good time. But sometimes it wasn't, initially, it wasn't always a voluntary situation. But it didn't take long. We had an expression. When I was flying, when I was giving instruction to, I would tell my students that you can do this maneuver any way you want to, but as long as you're here, you're going to do it our way. And you know, they got the message, and we did too. So, we followed pretty much the way he wanted to go. When we wanted to go to Florida, we all went to Florida. And when he wanted to go, in this case, to North Cape, we all did that. However, he was very, very generous. He had a yacht that would accommodate quite a few people, and we always went interesting places. I was on board one summer for a while. He would rotate people, guests, on board, and his chauffeur would sometimes drive them, let's say, to the Thousand Islands up in northern New York State. And they would drive up there and then pick up the ones that were on the yacht, bring them back to Lansing, while the others went on someplace. It was a rotating thing, so there was always a group of people milling around. And they were always congenial. They, to the best of my knowledge, had very little friction. Whether he did it intentionally or whether it just came naturally, it worked out beautifully.
Did you ever see him angry, really angry about something?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
What would anger him?
Well, one Sunday, I think I might have been around 10 years old, it was time to go to church, and my grandmother said, "Olds, have you got your got a clean handkerchief?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Let's see it." And I didn't. And that kind of teed Mr. Olds off. And we walked all the way upstairs and all the way back downstairs. And he had a hold of my ear, and I don't think my feet touched the ground very often on the way. And he was really angry. By and large, he had a very even disposition, a very even temper. But there were times when he could really flash it. And that was one of them that I remember. But he also had a tremendous sense of humor, and I think that predominated most of his life.
Do you remember any comical incidents?
Well, yeah. We went to church one Sunday, and we were a little bit late, but they very thoughtfully were waiting for us, And so we came down the aisle, and my grandmother went into the pew, and this was the First Baptist Church, went into the pew, and then I slid in, and my grandfather put his derby hat on the chair, not the chair, but the pew there, and then proceeded to take his coat off in the aisle because it was a little bit bigger. Well, he then turned around, sat right on his derby. Well, it made a terrible noise. So he started to laugh, and he snaked the derby out from underneath him, and then to make matters worse, he pushed it back into shape right in front of him, and of course the snapping of that derby back into shape made even more noise. My grandmother was highly embarrassed. I could hardly sit still. And he thought it was really something. But, he really had a great sense of humor. But he was a strict disciplinarian. He was very fair, very honest about things. And he had his own way of doing many things. And you just kind of went along with him. After all, he held all the cards. So, but there was never any show of power or anything like that. Nothing like that at all.
Was it really true that he didn't like horses?
No, I think that he probably liked horses as much as anybody did, but he didn't go riding. I probably would have followed in those footsteps had my father not come from Colorado. But he thought there were better ways of doing things, and he was just naturally, mechanically inclined to experiment with them.
When did you first begin to feel that your grandfather was really somebody?
Oh, I don't think I ever got to that point. I gradually began to realize, I think this is what you mean, that he was a little different than the average grandfather. But, you know, when you grow up with someone like that who really is not ostentatious or anything of that sort, you're just not aware of it. And that's one reason why he moved back to Lansing. And I heard him say this from Detroit when they were first getting started. Not only did he get financial backing in Lansing, but he didn't like Detroit to begin with because it was a high society town, even at the turn of the century. And that was not his style. So I don't think he had a great deal of difficulty moving back to Lansing.
Did he ever say why he moved to Detroit in the first place?
Well, yeah, because the money was there. Mm-hmm. And but then when they got burned out, you know, Olds Motor Works got burned out. 1901, yeah. Mm-hmm. Why, it was a golden opportunity to come back to Lansing.
So actually, perhaps in the back of his mind, he really almost wanted an opportunity to...
I would think so. Yeah, I would think so. I never heard him regret coming back to Lansing. I never heard him poke a finger at those people in Detroit. He had his own lifestyle, and he was comfortable with it. And from other people in the family, I did hear a certain amount of regret that they were not on the social whirl and things like that, but it didn't bother him. And he was comfortable.
What about Mrs. Oles, Meta Oles? Did she feel the same way?
Well, now that's a good question, and I certainly can't answer it. I never heard her talking about it. She was always right there at his side whenever he needed her. And so I just assumed that... she was prepared to follow.
Well,
because she certainly did. But I beyond that, I don't know.
Do you remember any incidents involving her goals when you were growing up or as you got older, specifically?
No, except that she was even more generous than he was, and that when they were first married, she was, well, I don't like to say on an allowance, but she was given a certain amount of money to manage the house, because, of course, in those days, you know, that's the only way the women could manage the house. And but she was in the habit of giving it away to those who needed it more at the church, at the sewing circle, things like that. And so when Grandpa stumbled onto that, he said, well, let's do it a little differently. And so at that point, I guess, any giveaway money came from the office. By that time, he had the Ari Olds company going, and they handled their finances in a different manner. And I really, to this day, have no idea how they did it. That we didn't talk about money. There was never a crisis. There was a crisis as far as I'm concerned, because I was of a different generation. But we didn't, in our family, we did not really discuss financial affairs or anything like that, at least in front of me. I had my own problems. I had my own allowance. I was accountable for it. At Cranbrook, we had, which I thought was an excellent way of doing things, we had a checking account within the school itself. And for instance, when we went down in the fall, why, we had a checking account that was $50. And if we wanted something from the school store, we wrote out a check. So we knew exactly how much we had in our account at any time. The checkbook, until we learned how to do it, had to be balanced and approved by the master on the floor, the counselor on the floor, so that it, we were just taught accountability. And it was time to get school books, write out a check, you bought them. If you ran out of money, then you had to explain to your folks how come you ran out of money. So it was a different world. That's what I'm saying. Accountability was a very high priority without coming out and saying so.
You never felt put upon that you had to account for your expenditures. That was just a good learning.
Well, at Cranbrook, that was a good learning experience. However, as we went along, I myself did not have unlimited spending ability. And there were times when, for instance, I wanted to, let's say, get a new car. I remember one in particular, and I had been driving this Oldsmobile for quite some time. And
was it bought new?
You know, well, I suppose so. I really don't know.
Okay. What model year was that?
Well, let me see if I can put that together. I graduated in 35 from Cranbrook, and my family was so happy to see me eventually graduate that they gave me a two-door Oldsmobile, a new car, 35. And Chuck Luce and Jack Maynard and I took a trip east, and we had a lot of fun with that car, but we were responsible for its maintenance and operating costs and all that. And about 2 years later, I'm sure it was, it was time to turn the car in because everybody did it at that time. Well, I knew a fellow by the name of Hansen, I can't think of his first name, who had the Studebaker agency. And he made me a better deal than the Oldsmobile agent.
Who was the Olds agent?
Well, it was right there on South Capitol Avenue. Probably. Was there a Hanson? No, Hanson was Studebaker.
That there was a Trevelyan.
Yeah. But I think it was before my dad got involved in the agency. And Van Curen and some of those guys.
He was involved in what agency?
Well, what later became Lansing Oldsmobile.
Oh.
I think they bought out Trevelyan.
Oh.
And so I needed $600 to make the trade for that new Studebaker.
1937 model?
Yeah, it was a President. Four-door, straight eight. Man, that was really some car. One of the best ones, incidentally, that I ever had. And so at that time, why, we had to go down and talk to Mr. Olds about those things, and he was in Florida. So I wrote him a letter, told him what I wanted, and I got a telegram back that said something to the effect that if I thought I could afford to throw away $600 for, how did he put it, another kind of a car other than Oldsmobile, then go ahead. But that $600 you won't see again. Well, I went ahead and had the Oldsmobile, Studebaker, and I think I drove it about 2 years, very happy with the whole thing. Wonderful road car. Red four-door, my, that was the stuff, I'll tell you. But then one thing led to another, and you get back into Oldsmobiles. And then when the war came along, of course, I didn't take a car to Houston, but rather I bought one down there. Because I knew I'd be there for a long time, so I got essentially what I wanted, which was a black convertible.
An Olds?
An Olds, yeah.
Don't you wish you had it now?
Well, only as a curiosity piece.
Yes.
I had three tops on that. The climate down there is such that your canvas top just wouldn't hold up. So I had three tops on that car before I finally sold it. And then flew an airplane back.